Welcome to Teacher Quit Talk. I'm Miss Redacted.
And I'm Mrs. Frazzled. Every week we explore the teacher exodus to find out what, if anything, could get these educators back in the classroom.
We've all had our moments where we thought, what the hell am I doing here? From burnout to bureaucracy to soul-sucking stressors and creative dead ends.
From recognizing when it was time to go to navigating feelings of guilt and regret afterwards, we're here to cut out the gaslighting and get real about what it means to leave teaching.
We've got insights from former teachers from all over the country who have seen it all. So get ready to be disturbed. Join us on Teacher Quit Talk to laugh through the pain of the U.S. education system. We'll see you there.
Hi, I'm Frances Callier.
And I'm Angela V. Shelton.
And we're Frangela.
You know what you need in your life? The Final Word podcast.
Yes, you do.
That's right. It is the final word on all things political and pop cultural.
Where we make real news real funny.
Where we inspire you so you can hashtag resist.
Subscribe and get a new episode of the Final Word podcast each week. It's the news we think you need to hear.
That's right. We think you need to hear it. Okay.
Yeah, it's what we say so.
That's right. And because all we do is give, every Thursday you can listen to our hysterical podcast, Idiot of the Week.
We round up the stupid because you know what? Somebody has to.
Okay. All we do is give.
Дамы и господа, добро пожаловать в Prevail. Это второй сезон нашей борьбы с криминальными сволочами. Ваш ведущий Грег О'Лиар.
I'm Greg O'Lear. This is Prevail. Welcome to the program. We've got a great show. Zarina Zabriskie is back. This time, she's calling in from Odessa, Ukraine. She's been on the ground in Ukraine reporting for the last couple of months. It's the first time I've talked to her since she's been there. So that's a really fascinating conversation. She's seen a lot of things, been even to some conferences, which is interesting. She went to Davos, the financial conference. We talk a little bit about that. We talk about the situation on the ground in Ukraine, the morale of the Ukrainian people. We talk about Zelensky and Macron and, of course, Putin and all of it. Really interesting conversation, as it always is, with Zarina. We'll get to that momentarily. I have not been tweeting much. I watched the hearing and the testimony of Shay Moss and her mother, Ruby Freeman, the election poll workers that were terrorized by Trump's minions. I mean, Giuliani and Trump just unleashed these awful, evil, disgraceful people on these innocent women doing their jobs, trying to make democracy work. And I couldn't tweet anything. I'm so angry. I can't fathom how we're letting these fucking assholes get away with this shit, and how the media just seems not to fucking grasp the severity of what we're seeing. We're still having arguments about, well, should Trump be indicted? I don't know if a sitting president, if a former president could be indicted. The only argument we should be making about Trump is whether what he did is a capital offense. That's it. What the punishment should be. That's the only debate. These are evil, evil men. They're just assholes. Cruel, mean, petty, violent. They are embodiments of the worst characteristics of humanity. They're just awful in every way. They are failed human beings. Failed. Just disgraceful. I run out of words to use for what these people are, Trump and Giuliani and the whole lot of them, Mike Flynn and Bannon and Roger Stone, just scumbags. I mean, just the dregs of humanity. And somehow they found themselves in charge of a country and did horrible things, tried to destroy this country, tried to destroy it, to take a proverbial axe to our institutions, to NATO, to the Department of Justice, to the Department of Defense, as everyone found out about on January 6th, to our election processes. There's nothing in this country more sacred than that, man. You can't do that. And the media just doesn't quite seem to grasp what's going on. It is confounding. And when I heard those women testify and saw their pain and how their lives had been disrupted, and you could feel, I mean, she seemed like she had been humiliated, and she doesn't deserve that. This is a heroic person. And I don't think Trump and Giuliani gave a second glancing thought to how their actions would impact her, her mother, her grandmother, and everyone. They just don't care. They have no empathy. They lack that chip. They should not be in charge of people. They're bullies. They're petty, vile people. And if they broke the law, which they did, they should be indicted and they should be punished to the full force of the law. And that's the only way we're going to get any relief in this country. That's the only way out. And I don't know what the hell we're waiting for. I really don't. I mean, I get it. I don't want to preach impatience or anything like that, but we're running out of time. And I don't know. This has to resolve, and it has to resolve in that way, or democracy is just not going to survive. It just isn't. You can't have people like this subverting and twisting and fucking with it and expect that it's going to just hold. You can't. Democracy is work. You have to work to achieve democracy. And it's a privilege to live in a democratic, free society. And these MAGA people are too fucking stupid to understand that. Or they just don't care. And they would rather be the militia of this fascist strongman dipshit. It's a disgrace. And I have nothing to tweet about. I've got nothing to say. I feel so badly for those women. And I feel such contempt and hatred for the men who did that to them. Okay, moving on. A couple of notes about programming. I'm recording this on Wednesday night at 9:30. You're listening to this probably on Friday, the 24th. There will be no 5-8 show tonight on the 24th. There will be a 5-8 show next week on Friday, which I believe is July 1st. On July 1st, there will not be a new Prevail podcast, but there'll be a new one the week after that. And Friday's missive that will accompany this podcast, which is going to be called, I think, Team Peace, Team Justice, for reasons that will be explained soon, is going to be the last thing I'm going to write until next Sunday. I'm not going to be tweeting, I don't think, and I'm not going to be writing anything, and I'm not going to be recording anything. I have a special project that I'm working on, and it requires me to be incommunicado for about a week. So nothing bad. It's kind of good, but I need to stay radio silent for a little while. So you're going to hear from me live in 2 weeks. Actually, in 1 week, if you watch the 5-8, I'll be on Friday on the 5-8. And then the week after that, we're going to come back here on the Prevail podcast. As for this particular show, for whatever reason, Zoom decided to not recognize my excellent Snowball Ice mic that I use, that even though the red light was on and I was talking into it. So my voice sounds tinny and robot-like, which is kind of annoying, but you know, she talks more than I do, so it's okay. So I apologize for that. I don't know. Usually it just defaults to it and I didn't even think to check. So from now on, I'm going to have to check, make sure that the default microphone is the correct microphone. I'm sorry about that. I'll also add that towards the end, about an hour into the interview, there was an air raid while we were talking, which did not even give her the slightest pause. Zarina is very brave, but there was an air raid, and we later found out it was because Zelensky was in Odessa, and that's why the air raid sirens were going off. He was safe, she was safe, everything was fine. So that did happen, and that was why. I think that's all I got. All right, I'm going to talk to you again on the podcast in 2 weeks. We'll be right back with my friend, Zarina Zabriskie. Loves her, but we
with SCOTUS? And at home, where's the pants? She's buds with Leonard Leo, Dark Money Grand Design, Sam and the new Trump Troika, Ginny Thomas on 6 of 9, Ginny Thomas on 6 of 9, Ginny Thomas on 6 of 9, Ginny Thomas on 6 of 9.
Zarina Zabriskie, welcome back to the Prevail Podcast.
Hi, Greg. It's always so great to see you and to hear you.
It's great to see you too. I'm very happy that you're, first of all, that you're safe and sound. Last time we spoke, which was it after you were still in the United States and still kind of furiously processing all this information. You were monitoring Telegram channels and letting us all know on Twitter what was happening. And at the time you were like, I need to go there. And everybody that you knew was like, do not go there, including me, because I am a physical coward and I did not want anything to happen to you that would be bad. But you were on a mission and you went there and you look very happy since you went. I think you're very, I think you made the right decision. And I think the work there has been really good. So, start with that. Like, what was that like? How did you feel emotionally when you got back to Ukraine?
Thanks for this question. And thank you for being concerned then and for being kind now and seeing that I am happier being here, contradicting as it may sound. But when we last spoke, I was waiting for the accreditation so I can come here safely, because for anybody who is listening and wants to jump on a plane and just fly here, don't do it unless you do have a special mission and you do have all the needed accreditation and documentation, because it is a war zone. There are block posts and there are checkpoints on the road and in the street, and they do check your documents. And unless you have it in order, don't come. So that having been said, it took me quite a while to get everything in order because they check you, and it's a good thing. I have been here in and out because I did leave for some conferences that I believe we will mention.
Yeah, we'll get to that. Yeah,
but the first feeling by now, it's been a while. So it's been a few months by now. So it was kind of cold then and wintry and very harsh and made me very, very sad on the one hand, because the ideas that I knew and brought back with me from the previous year, just before the war, was warm and festive and celebratory and with fireworks and music everywhere. And suddenly there was this desolate place with sandbags. The sandbags were killing me. By now I'm used to them and they're not as many, but at the time that could be described as winter because it was cold. I guess it was spring more like, but it felt like winter. It was very cold. And those sandbags, they look like dead alien caterpillars. Okay. They're white and fat and they are piled up on top of each other. And you walk down a beautiful European street with Italian architecture, Baroque and Rococo, and then there's those alien caterpillars. And then it did remind me of the invasion of evil alien insects, because the anti-tank hedgehogs looked like giant iron spiders, like modern sculpture. And it took a while to get used to it also because the trees were all bare. But on the other hand, it was great to be back. And I kind of got the sense of purpose, because although I was reporting 24/7 on Twitter, it didn't feel like I was contributing to our future victory. And for some reason, once you cross the border, this feeling changes and there's a sense of purpose. And of course, since then, it all changed again. And now it's summer, and summer is beautiful in Odessa. It's like the most beautiful city in the world. And of course, now you cannot swim in the sea because it's all mined by the, you know, there, and also there are ships, not necessarily, you know, there's self-defense, and there are even the World War II mines that are now being found.
Oh my God.
It's crazy. You know, the history repeats itself. And there are ships that are out there in the Black Sea, and yes, there are air raids, every day, sometimes 3 to 4 times a day. But funny enough, you get used to it. You stop noticing them. You just, you know, it's kind of like a mosquito. I know there's a lot of insect references, but I guess that's how I feel about Russians. They're that big to me, like, you know, like annoying, terrible insects, like blood.
It's the season. You know, we have them here in New York. The mosquitoes suddenly have appeared. So yeah, I think it's a perfectly good analogy. And purpose, I'm glad you said the word purpose, because I think that that's exactly what, at least as an observer of you and your mood, which was obvious in both senses, I think that it was clear that going there did give you a sense of purpose. I'm fascinated by the videos of when Zelensky is in that square in Kyiv, and foreign leaders come to meet him, and they're all in the same square. I find those, I don't know why, I find those videos fascinating. I don't know if it's because you sort of know right off the bat, 50 years from now, people are going to be watching these videos. This is like the kind of, you know, stock footage they'll show on the History Channel 50 years from now. And why is Mitch McConnell there? Like, you know, and it's watching these foreign leaders navigate what must be a very uncomfortable situation in a million different ways. I mean, so much can go wrong. Starting with a bomb could go off, or it could be violent or something like that, but that you could say something wrong and everyone's watching you. So you have like Boris Johnson is there, and I don't know. I find it fascinating. And every time he's there in the square, and again, I'm sitting here in New York, and I've been paying attention to the war more than many people have, but I'm not, you know, 24/7 doing it. I feel a sense of comfort knowing that those guys are still there. Somebody did a meme about it. I think it was the 100 days of the war, where at the first day they took a picture, it was Zelensky and the three guys with him. And then they took another picture in the same spot, in the same poses 100 days later. And it's very stirring, you know, stuff. And what's your take on Zelensky now and the way he's been perceived? Is it the same as it was last time we spoke? Has it been elevated? What's your take on what's going on with him?
A great question, Greg. I actually just interviewed one of the leading political and military analysts just before we had started the podcast with you. And he just confirmed to me, he's local here in Odessa, Ukrainian, that Zelensky's rating is really, really high right now. And there's a lot of confidence in him. That having been said, it's important to understand that here Zarina starts speaking about her favorite quote-unquote subject, information warfare and hybrid war. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, we can't get anywhere without mentioning it. And they're still at it. And they're still basically pumping really well-made, in a sense that it is efficient, propaganda into the minds of every people, every country on earth, and that includes the Ukrainians. So they're targeting Ukrainians, which is easier for them than, say, targeting Americans, because 99.9% Ukrainians understand Russian very, very well. Right. So, also a lot of Russian propagandists by now can operate in Ukrainian. So it's coming from every crack, and they're trying to poison the relationship with the government and with the officials, and just basically using any opportunity to degrade the government or to paint them black or in a villainous way. And there are many, many narratives. And there are groups of people who would fall for it as anywhere. So there, you know, overall, yes, a very high degree of confidence in President Zelensky. But we need to be realistic. There are some people who believe all kind of things, including that the earth is flat. So,
it's amazing what people will believe. That's what we see here in the US as we're recording this. It's June 18th as we're recording this, and we're having these hearings, and you just see some of the batshit stuff that people believed that made them go to Washington on January 6th and, you know, besiege the Capitol. It's crazy. Because I think most of the people that participated in that believed it. They believed the hype and the propaganda and disinformation fed by the sitting president of the United States on January 6, 2021. So, of course, it would work in a war zone, by people who, you know, in Russia are very, very good at it, probably the best at it of anybody anyway. So I want to talk more about the war in a second, but you mentioned your press credentials. Who are you working for these days?
Okay, not such a long list. There are many more journalists who work for more publications than I do, but I traditionally have always been writing for the Byline Times, which I recommend to everyone, Peter Dukes and Stefan Colgrave, and by now a great team of journalists. And I left Ukraine first time to go and speak at the Byline Festival in London, which was terrific, and a lot of good people spoke there. So Byline Times is I can say working together, but they are aware of each other's presence in the information space with the ByWire News, which is a relatively new platform. And they have, I'm not an expert, but according to them, they have invented an algorithm, artificial intelligence, that verifies news. So instead of not enough people at Facebook verifying all our comments, they have the artificial intelligence that does it. And so they were very persuasive, and I started to write for them. So check them out. Quite a few of my articles about Ukraine and information warfare are now at ByWire News. So I work for them. And I have been writing on and off for the very respectable newspaper with a sterling reputation, Ukrainian one in English, is called Euromaidan Press. And it has been around since 2014. And we had that kind of cooperation going on because they quoted me, I quoted them, and it's been going on for years. But what happened, Greg, when I found myself here without any distraction and propelled by my passion and, you know, passions, I produced so much that it was too much for my British newspapers. They said hey, we're covering other countries too, you know, and I stopped writing. As you can see, I'm not writing about the States right now, I'm not writing about anything. And so I started to look for another good publication or an outlet that I respect. And naturally, Euromaidan Press was there. So I started to write for them more. And one thing led to another, and now I'm fully employed by Euromaidan Press as of the last week, and I'm an analyst for them. So check out the daily news we're doing. It's pretty much what I've been doing on Twitter if everybody was following me for the first 2 months of war. And then I kind of stopped because I was writing a lot of articles and going to all these conferences, but I missed it and I felt like it needs to be done. Yeah. And so now I'm back in that capacity, doing every other day, alternating with a former NATO military attaché who is very good. So it's we have a good variety. Plus, I'm still writing for all these other publications, and I'm writing for Euromaidan Press.
That's, you're busy as always. And I'm glad to see it. I'm glad you're there. I'm glad you're doing the work. And you know, these daily dispatches about the war and what happens day to day, I think are super valuable. Even if they don't feel it in the moment, it's incredibly valuable to document what happens day to day, to be able to then go back 6 months from now, a year from now, 10 years from now, and really fully go through things. I found this in my own writing about the Trump-Russia stuff. Like, you go through, and if you go back and look, you could say, oh, at this date, we knew about this. At this date, we knew about that. People were talking about this guy at this time, and I don't know, they stopped. So, you know, in addition to everything else, it's just as a historical document, I think it's incredibly worthwhile and good. So, my God, you're so busy, which is great, which is also, I think, why you're, you know, happier.
I know. I'll give you a very short anecdote, because I'm also trying to document anything I see. I'm writing eyewitness stories, interviewing the displaced people internally, and whatever comes my way, basically, I try to write it. And last night we had kind of a historic event. If you look at my Twitter, I posted there the videos from the Odessa Opera Theater, which reopened for the first time since the beginning of the war. And before that, even the access to the theater was blocked. You couldn't come close. And suddenly we could go in, and there was this beautiful opera gala with Verdi and Puccini and Bizet and Godot, like whatnot, and Ukrainian composers, of course. And it was, you could like touch history like an animal there, like yeah. You felt it was palpable in the air. And so, and of course it's so unique because there's a bomb shelter there. The theaters could only function if there's a bomb shelter because we have 3 or 4 air raids every night. Mm-hmm. So just before the show, they tell you, you know, usually they say, switch off your phones, and here they tell you switch off your phones. And oh, if the air raid starts, your usher will take you to the basement. And if the air raid is longer than 1 hour, we will not resume the show, but with your ticket, you can come back to another show. Because there, so I mean, that was kind of really overwhelming and very emotional. And I also published my first daily news analytics yesterday. And when I came home, there was no air raid, it was all fine. I came home, tried to write an article, and I just fell asleep. And when I woke up in the morning to go to my daily staff meeting in Ukrainian, I'm learning Ukrainian on top of everything else. I see that, like, oh, there were some explosions, that the whole city was up and talking, like the walls were shaken, the glass was shaken. I slept through it like a baby. I had no idea what. I asked my friend, what happened? It's like, what? There were 2 missiles that our air defense shot down over the city. I had no clue. I was that tired.
That's what happens, I guess. You know, you have to adapt to the environment. It's funny that you said that you're at the Opera House, because on one of the podcasts when you were here, you told me you compared Putin or the Russian people to the bad guy in Tenet. And I watched Tenet, the movie by Christopher Nolan. I've watched it, I think, 3 times. I really like it. But the opening scene in Tenet, when they come in and take everyone, where are they? They're at the Opera House in Ukraine. That's where they are. I don't know if it's the one in Odessa, but yeah.
Yes, actually, this is terrific. No, it's not in Odessa, because that was a very modern theater.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The one in Odessa is like one of the top opera houses from the 19th century in Europe. Forbes puts it on the first place, actually. It's a remarkable building. It's really gorgeous. And at that time, in 1880s, like the beginning of 1880s, it was really revolutionary. They had basements in which they kept ice in summer, and there is an opening under each seat so the cold or cool air comes in, because it's hot in Odessa in summer. So people enjoy the opera in a comfortable air conditioning.
That's really smart. That's, you know, early air conditioning. Okay.
It is. Yeah. It is. But, you know, the opening under each chair, I was thinking, you know, if anybody wants to use it, just like in Tenet, you know, that's.
Right. Yeah. Imaginations run wild. But that's great. It's great news that the Opera House opened and that they're doing these shows, because it's important to, you know, to have joy in life. You can't just be miserable and worried and you know, in flight or fight mode all the time. You can't do it.
This is not a situation here at all. And I was talking to a colleague of mine, a journalist here, he's Austrian, Klaus, and he said something that I really hit me as the right definition. He said, I forgot, do we curse on this program?
Oh, yes, yes.
Yeah. So he said, like the opera and like sitting at a restaurant, you know, like on the terrace having a coffee, or people dress up very nicely. He said, this is like one big fuck you to Putin.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And that's just so true. Yeah.
Yeah. He's right. And they say that, you know, if you're in these situations, you're a prisoner or whatever, even it's important to like to shave every day, like to have these basic routines of taking care of yourself, because it keeps you, it helps keep you sane, you know, mentally. It's good for your mental health, in addition to being just a nice thing to go do. Now, you mentioned conferences. I want to come back at the in the second half of this and talk about the war in general, but you mentioned the conferences. You went to Davos, which is that economic forum where all these wonky libertarian, you know, the people that run the planet, you know, in the conspiracy talk, they're always talking about this. Well, you know, they decided blah, blah, blah. And you were there and you covered it and you spoke. So tell us about that. What was your impression of, first of all, what is Davos? And what was your impression of it? What were you doing there?
I mean, I think as a writer, you know, writer to writer, you tend to put yourself in these bizarre situations that are great for writing, but might not be great for anything else. And that ranges from a war situation to oil field to Davos, or, you know, things like this. And it's not my first experience at all with the multi-billionaires. When I was working a long time ago as a translator, I worked for Americans and Europeans and Brits, and some of them were like some of the, you know, most rich people in the world. It just because there were not that many good translators at the time available. And I wasn't even that great, but I mean, you know, like once you make it in a certain position, like then you become, that's what you do. And so I've seen their habits before. I'm not impressed. I don't believe that money make people happy or clever or better in any way. Most of them are miserable, you know. I'm sorry, rich people listening to us, I'm sorry, I'm sure you are great and an exception to the rule, but the ones I've met were not particularly always impressive. But it was a bit of a circus there. And I came there to speak about Ukraine. I'd go anywhere, like, you know, like if Elon Musk takes me to the moon tomorrow to speak about what's going on here, I'll go. But first of all, the logistics, you know, it's high up in the mountain and it's really hard to get there. You take a train and staying in the city, or it's a town of Davos, is pretty much impossible because we're talking tens of thousands of dollars, like very few people can afford it. So my crew, which was a news crew, was staying in a chalet far away. We every day we had to drive through this gorgeous, beautiful road, which was also very dangerous. So it felt very dangerous because sometimes it's raining or it's foggy. And the road, like, I'm from California and I'm used to twists and turns, but that was nothing compared to Swiss road. And then once you arrive there, it's not like you walk around at any other conference. You have to have a special registration or a special token to get into the house you kind of assign to. And so we were with the crypto house of Brittany Kaiser, the whistleblower for Cambridge Analytica.
Okay.
But we spent 99.9% of the time in the House of Ukraine, not to be confused with Ukraine House, which was a secret high security zone. And there you couldn't even approach. I actually ran into someone I know from San Francisco who was supposed to speak there. She was from Moldova, and she was a speaker in the high security zone. And she never spoke because she couldn't get there. That's where all the top echelon people, like Kissinger, were probably there. We didn't run into him. But the other, like every house is like the little microcosm of its own. And everybody wants to meet everybody because just by being there, by definition of being there, you are someone. So you would have like people randomly come to you and to anyone, not just to me, but anyone, and give the cards and say, I'm such and such, who are you? And it's like, who are you? I don't know you. I'm just a journalist. You know? Yeah.
You didn't want to mess with anybody? You weren't like, I'm Donatella Versace. That's, you can do better with your clothes, like whatever, you know, just.
Well, I hope not, but there were some, I don't want to give any examples, but people do, you know, even if they find out that you're a journalist, they want you to write about them. That there is a lot of vanity there.
No way. Rich people want you to write about them? I'm shocked.
Yeah. And the funny thing that it's really hard to get a meal in Davos. We were laughing a lot because, you know, we were hunger crisis in the world, but we had a little hunger crisis of our own because at the restaurant there, like a lunch would be 50, 60 euros.
Well, sure. If I'm a restaurateur in Davos, I'm like, I'm jacking up the prices this weekend. Menu going up. These people can afford it. So there's no McDonald's. There's no McDonald's.
There are no McDonald's. And actually, there are a couple of cafes in the like little square in the middle, but they are not allowed to sit there. Like we sat there and they come to you and they'll know these are assigned seats. Please, miss, leave. So we have funny photographs where we're sitting just on the steps, like looking at homeless. And we bought food in a little tiny supermarket where I have a picture somewhere. There's a line of very rich people lining up for sandwiches. And they're like wraps. The funniest thing was there, a wrap, like a veggie wrap called Karma. And we, at some point, we ended up at the House of Equality, again, okay. Not a joke, true story, where I positioned myself next to the kitchen where the food, like the little finger food was coming from. So the waiters were very kind because we were like also working people, you know, so they would feed us some.
So this is fascinating. It's very funny. So there's not like one big Davos thing. It's everything exists in these separate like houses. That's how it works.
Well, that's my only experience in Davos. Based on my experience, that's how it worked. And unless you're invited and specially registered in this house, you can't go in. And even sometimes I was registered in the house, but there would be a private party for Ukraine, say, and I have accreditation from the Ministry of Defense from Ukraine, and I still couldn't get in because it's private.
Wow. Well, who's there? I just feel like these guys are like, okay, how can we make money from the war? Is that what it is? Is that why they care about Ukraine?
Greg, I wish I could tell you, but I literally spent 99% of the time in the House of Ukraine, which was actually great because there we had real Ukrainians who either came from Ukraine to speak about the war or people who came to help. And it was a different atmosphere. And we had a terrific presentation by the Minister of Digital Transformation of Ukraine, who is also Vice Prime Minister of Ukraine. And he was amazing. And I got to interview him at the press conference afterwards and had a lengthy conversation. And I wrote an article about his presentation. Apparently most people don't know about it, but Ukraine is one of the most digitalized countries in the world. They're way ahead of the States. They have a program called a state in the phone. So you can have a bank account open on your phone within 3 minutes. You have your electronic passport, and it's the first country to. Estonia also has it. But yeah, so you have your whole packet of documents. They have all kind of apps running on the special special program software called DIA, and you could do anything there from watching television when Russians switch off your television programs, it's still available through internet, to reporting dead Russian soldiers or spies with a face recognition. I mean, it's digitalized to the sci-fi level. I have a short article about it describing how it works on BioWire. If somebody is interested, take a look. It's fascinating. And we had a big screen there. So Zelensky spoke and most government officials spoke, and there were terrific panels from Europe on the hybrid war and information war resistance and counterattacks. There were like the leading countries and the ministers from this country. So Estonia, Lithuania, Sweden. I'm actually lined up to do an interview with the Swedish minister because they are the first country in the world opening a psychological department within to fight the Russian propaganda in the country in general. Fascinating stuff. So that house, I mean, I really professionally, you know, despite being hungry, you know, that was an incredible dialogue and there was a great spirit. And there was a lot also about cryptocurrencies and, you know, also with a crypto house. But I am not an expert on cryptocurrencies and I cannot speak about it coherently, unfortunately.
That's okay. I think it's going to go by the wayside. You know, I've had people on since the podcast started talking about crypto, and I've asked people to sort of explain it to me. And when I had Scaramucci on, he was on one of the first couple of people I had on, and he was going, you know, he told me what it was and what books to read to understand it, which was nice. And I put like, I think $500 into Bitcoin when he came on. And that $500 is now worth like $200. So, you know, and it's going to be worth like $25 soon. It's.
I mean, I wouldn't take any advice from Scaramucci. I have a tiny little nasty article about him on my blog. I hope he never reads it.
He was very nice to me, I have to say. He was a very charming guy, and he's smart, and he is a finance guy. That's why, you know, for all of the media stuff and everything else he's done, at the end of the day, he's a guy that does finance. That's how he came up. So I bought it really as a lark more than anything else, just to see what would happen. And now I know. Now I know. It was like I paid $250 for a class that I'm never going to get back, right? So Davos, okay, so it's this mountainous place. It's weird that it's there, like, and there's no food. Like, go to France, guys. Go to Lyon. There's beautiful restaurants there, you know, that you'll never want for a meal, you know? I don't understand these people.
I'm sure other people had different experiences. I've seen them eating, you know, from outside. I saw them consuming food. Well, one last thing I should probably mention about Davos is the house of Russian war crimes, because before it used to be a big, big Russian thing. That's where just, you know, last Davos conference, which didn't happen because of COVID for a while, but the previous one that actually was live was run basically by the Russian oligarchs. And now they are suddenly out of fashion and no, in their fancy Russian, quote unquote, Russian chalet, which is a Swiss chalet, was turned into this art installation by Ukrainians. And that was a very powerful exhibit. I went there because I thought that we'll shoot a story there because we had a TV crew. And I ended up just crying and being basically sick because it was a very powerful thing. And I think that was the right thing to do. And people were shocked. Like it was silence there. There were just a few large photographs of what happened there. And that was just something else.
Wow. Well, this is a good segue into the next part of the show when we talk about the war, unfortunately. I wish we could be talking about something more pleasant, but you know, that's we got to do what we got to do. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back with Serena Zabriskie.
Hey, it's Kimberly, host of the Start Me Up podcast. If you like your politics with some loose talk and salty language, you're going to love my show. I interview the coolest people like Mary Trump, Kathy Griffin, and DNC chair Jamie Harrison. The Start Me Up podcast has an easygoing, casual style and a strong emphasis on left-leaning politics. We also have frank discussions about sex and more than a few spirited rants. Just visit patreon.com/startmeup or wherever you get your podcasts and start listening today.
Hi, everybody. It's AG from the Daily Beans.
Hey, this is Kimberly Johnson, host of the Start Me Up podcast.
Hi, it's Frangela from the Final Word and Idiot of the Week podcast.
Hi, this is Jody Hamilton of the From the Bunker podcast.
Hi, it's Mariah
and Steve from How We Win.
And we are joining forces to support the How We Win Fund.
The midterms are coming, and the best way we can fight back against the Republicans is to support Democrats in key battleground states.
Our democracy is under attack, but we don't agonize.
We organize.
Yes, we do.
Together, we can protect and expand our Democratic majority this November.
We are so close to a Sinna Manchin-proof majority in the Senate. Take them out.
Join the MSW Media family of podcasts and support the races that need us the most by donating to Swing Left's National Impact Fund.
Just one donation goes directly to all of Swing Left's top races.
A GOP stoking hate, peddling lies, and suppressing our vote means we need everyone to step up to protect
voting rights,
civil rights,
abortion rights, the environment,
constitutional gender equality,
the government, our institutions,
all the things.
Do it. Okay. We beat Trumpism before, and together we will make history again.
So go to swingleft.org/fundraise/howwewin to donate what you can, share this with your friends and family, and let's show the GOP that the grassroots persistence is here to stay.
This is How We Win.
Okay, we're back with Serena Zabriskie. Before we took the break, you mentioned the exhibit in Davos, and now the war has been going on for, what, 120 days, something like that. It's been a while, and Russia clearly is not going to invade and take over Ukraine. I think that much is clear. But I think the will of some people in the Western world has, as you feared and as other people feared, started to waver when we see what the long-term effects are. The New York Times editorial board wrote a completely cowardly op-ed a couple weeks ago saying, well, you know, this was nice, but let's come back to the compromise table, Zelensky. And the thing is, the war can be over tomorrow if Russia just fucking leaves. And there's nothing else to really say. If Mexico invades the United States and takes over, you know, Los Angeles County, and occupies it and is having air raids during film screenings, we're not going to listen when somebody says, well, you know, just come to the compromise table, just let Mexico have LA. I was going to say Texas, except that we would totally let Mexico keep Texas, solve a lot of problems here. But, you know, that's the analog. And yet there does seem to be some wavering. You see, there's definitely a counter narrative now among, you know, some Western powers that, okay, maybe it's time to compromise. Maybe we need to go to the negotiation table. And my position is, with who? The guy's fucking Hitler, this guy. He's a madman. He's not going to stop. He's never going to stop by surrendering even an inch of territory to him. All we're doing is giving him the green light for the next time he tries it. So I don't know. What do you think is happening now in terms of that? Where do you see the war going, I guess, in the next couple of weeks, months, whatever?
Well, excellent point, and an excellent point to get into the whole war update and summary and review, because, you know, there's a very simple explanation for all this, what they call the fashionable term, I think, is a peace team versus justice team. So the so-called peace team that the New York Times gladly jumped on is just nothing but just the Russian lobby.
Yeah.
I mean, there is, let's just call things, I am sitting in Ukraine, I have nothing to lose, you know. There's call things what they are. There's infiltration. Russians were working, and I've been writing about it for years and years, ad nauseum. They've been working on the sleeper agents, on infiltration, on useful idiots. That's all other elements of the hybrid war. It's called, it has a name. It's called the fifth column. And not everybody there is bribed. Some people are brainwashed. Some people are compromised. Some people have financial interests. And some people were persuaded because they're vulnerable for one reason or another. So whatever the reason are, they are playing in the Kremlin's favor here. And we see it consistently in the New York Times. I mean, this is, you mentioned this one, the screaming example, and you did a great analysis of that and breakdown. And several people wrote to me before you did it, asking to write about it. And I didn't have time, nor frankly, even a desire to do that, because at this point, it's just so maddening. But thank you for doing that. That was really needed.
It was the easiest thing I've ever written. It took like an hour to, because it was so stupid what they wrote. Anyway, thank you.
Unfortunately, the thing, the problem is that that's not how brainwashing and propaganda works. Once somebody is converted, you can't use logic or rationale to unbrainwash people, because it's a physical process and there are certain processes that are happening in the brain. So to revert this train of thought, we need different means. And this is what I'm going to talk to the Swedish Ministry of Disinformation and Information Warfare, rather than not disinformation. But apparently, in New York Times, you see even the some kind of email distribution that I receive on a daily basis, I think, or every other day, on specifically Russia, Ukraine. Part of good, big part of it is a provocation. And the same thing I see in other publications, too. Like the other day, there was a conversation, I think, on the White House website, and I think it was Blinken or maybe Lloyd, probably Blinken, interrogated basically by the CNN, asking the same question with the peace narrative. Don't you think, you know, it's like you say that they receive their outlines right from the Kremlin. Don't you think that this is the time when Ukraine, blah, blah. And actually, I was very happy to read Blinken's, I believe, answers or Lloyd's answers saying that no, we are not deciding for Ukrainians. Ukrainians are the only ones who will decide, and Ukrainians are being invaded, and most likely they will decide that thanks, but no thanks. And your example of Mexico is fantastic. I was thinking that, you know, to give a his parallel in history, England would work. England, America, you know, like America used to belong to the UK. And then suddenly Boris Johnson turns around and says, like, wait a minute, I want New York. They speak English. You guys speak English. Right. That's basically the basis. And now you are waving American flags there. Well, sorry, you are Nazis. You want to speak, you know, you are speaking our language. Go back to the Great Britain. It's great. Britain is great, you know? Yeah.
Make Britain great again.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, this is like, it's not even hilarious. It's stupid, right?
Right.
Same would be with Mexico, because yes, California used to be
part of Mexico. It did.
And very recently, if you look at the history. And Alaska, by the way, was a part of Russia. So yeah, let's get on with it. That's not how it works, people. That's, you know, the international law, the sovereignty of countries. And apparently, you know, there's a country, not just one, but one country in this world currently is breaking all international laws. And nobody in their sane mind, unless they're brainwashed or compromised by the Kremlin, should be in this peace camp. There's only one camp, justice. You know, I repeat very often, it's a quote from Bulgakov. He wrote Master and Margarita. It's a very good novel, if you haven't read it. There's a great quote there, the devil arrives to Moscow and goes to a restaurant and being served fish, and this like this fishy smell is like, yeah, it's not the first category of freshness, it's the second category of freshness. And he says, like, you know, there is no categories of freshness. There's fresh fish and there's spoiled fish, there's rotten fish. So there is no, you know, there's no peace camp.
Yeah.
It's second category.
It's part of their, and by their, I mean, Russia's play. I mean, Rand Paul, okay, the senator from Kentucky, who has been carrying water for Russia for a long, I mean, McCain said he was working for Vladimir Putin on the floor of the fucking Senate. This guy is full-on traitor. But one of the arguments that he always makes is, well, we need engagement. You know, he brings up the peace thing. Isn't it good to engage the Russians? Isn't it? We need engagement. And that was the excuse that the 4th of July traitors, as I call them, the eight members of Congress who went to Moscow on the 4th of July, 2018, and then subsequently came back to the United States and have been, especially Ron Johnson, just spewing Russian propaganda since he came back. I mean, I wrote about it fairly early on, and it just, yep. I said this would happen, and here it keeps happening. Like, and they got, I don't know what his deal is. He's either dumb or they got some money, because he has a lot of money already. They didn't need to buy him. But engagement, peace, you know, understanding, these are things that rational people would be like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Tulsi Gabbard is another one that likes to talk this way. Well, we need engagement. We need to keep talking. We need to keep the dialogue open. We don't need to keep the dialogue open. You know, we already know what he's going to say. And the answer is, get the fuck out of Ukraine, or that's it, you know, or we're going to keep trying to destroy your economy until you're gone. I mean, the answer to this is only going to be, I think, you know, I'm just an English major. I'm not a geopolitical expert here, but until he's gone and removed from power, and whether that's in a coup in Russia or, you know, if he's sick and dies or something else, this is just going to keep happening. So, you know, I think Biden said something to that effect months ago. This man has to be removed. I forget the exact quote, but this man got to go, is paraphrasing what he said. And that's it. That's the goal. That's the objective of this. Either he gets out of Ukraine or he leaves. Those are the two things. We're not talking to anybody in Russia until that happens. And I think Biden and Blinken and those guys, the Americans, have been, thank goodness, because this, as you know, for me, this is an important issue. They've been pretty resolute. And anytime anybody gives Biden any guff, I say, he stands up to Putin. We couldn't say that about Trump. And I hate to say it, but we couldn't say it about Obama either, because Obama was president when Putin took Crimea the first time. So Biden is doing exactly what we want him to be doing. What's the deal, you think, with Macron? And what's the guy's name in Germany? What's his, Olaf?
Scholz.
Yeah. What's their deal? Are they seem like maybe they're wavering. I can't figure Macron out. I don't understand what he's trying to do.
Well, I mean, if you can't, I get. I mean, it's again, the two magic words are Russian lobby. I mean, there's a lot of money there. And, you know, we're talking Europe. We're talking gas. Mm-hmm. We're talking oil, and we're talking gas again, you know, the whole Nord Stream deal.
Right, right.
Germany is basically in Putin's pocket. I mean, these were the most criminal, not stupid, because they're not stupid, they're criminal. You know, like somebody does something without knowing the consequences, that's stupid. We're talking about politicians there. They are no English majors. They actually know what they do, and it's not you and I. And they knew exactly what Nord Stream 1, Nord Stream 2 were about, and they still do. And it's maddening when you are here to see what Germany is doing. There are a lot of jokes. Ukrainians are very good at laughing and at making jokes about it. So there's like, I heard the other day that there are two new verbs in Ukrainian. One is to Macron. It's like to go both ways, actually. Like he's coming here, but at night he's calling Putin. And there's the Scholz to promise a lot and not to do it or deliver it in a year or so. So like, you know, I just Scholz this girl, you know, Macron this lady. You know, when during Brexit, there was also, I think in America, we're headed to like Brexit, like the cat does the Brexit shit, in or out, in or out. So So, yeah, basically, they were here 2 days ago, and I was covering their visit, and it was all very great and moving, and they all looked very scared when the air raid started as soon as they arrived. Like, you see their faces, they're looking up at the sky, and I mean, it's not funny, but after a while, it becomes a bit, you know, you got to laugh at that. And we'll see what they do. I mean, now today, Scholz is insistent that they will send their weapons. I'm working right now on a quite big article slash interview with leading experts on the weapons, on the weapons supplies, because there's a lot of contradictions and confusion there, because Ukrainians are asking for certain amounts. And it's not even the same amount. If you look at different Ukrainian officials, there are different numbers. And then say the American experts would say, we only have that much. We can't give you what you demand because we don't have as much, which, you know, I'm going to analyze that, talking to the Ukrainian side, to Americans, to Europeans, compare it all and present. So I'm really looking forward to putting it together and showing how it works. But as for Macron, he just wants to be, my impression after, you know, 4 years of Macron, and I have French friends who are very close, so I hear a lot from them. He's just like this politician who wants to be loved by all, and it's not working out. He wants his people, the French people, love him, and Zelensky and Putin and John and everyone. So we'll see how he succeeds with that. Good luck.
I noticed that as soon as like Zelensky started showing up, like with the military-ish, the green sweatshirt on or whatever it's called, that Macron started to dress, you know, stop wearing suits and ties a little bit. He was clearly trying to channel it. It was kind of sad. But you mentioned the weapons. This is going to be an interesting article that you're going to gather here, this information. There's this thing where they're like, well, we're going to send weapons, but we don't want weapons that can hit inside Russia too far. And I feel like, why on earth not? I mean, if Putin is sitting there and feels no threat from Ukraine to strike back, like, isn't that a bad thing? I don't know.
Well, there are too many complications and too many consequences that it could lead to. Actually, it is a reasonable point. The funny thing that Ukrainians don't even ask for this weapons, and they do insist that they are not going to invade or go into the Russian territory. They just defend in their own. They don't want the Russian land, unlike Putin, who wants the whole Ukraine. And I think we are at this point, we are past that. I think that's not what's being debated right now. Whether it's feasible to meet these requirements, the numbers of the particular specific type of weapons. And I'm obviously not by any means an expert on weapons, but I'm doing a thorough research on it with some of the best military minds, and I will be verifying it and reporting. And sometimes next week, God willing, hopefully, or whatever is, you know, willing, I will have some good numbers and some good assessments, because I want to understand it myself. I don't have I can't speak to you now because I don't have clarity. I have all these contradicting numbers and all the contradicting statements by all the sides. So it would be not good judgment to come, you know.
I understand. You don't want to get ahead of your skis or whatever they say.
No, I don't do that unless I understand. So I'm going to present it for the public so everybody can make their own conclusion based on facts.
I'm excited to see that, and make sure you send it to me before when it comes out.
Well, yeah. You know, for the audience, it will be on Euromaidan Press.
Okay.
So they have a lot of good materials there, and that will be one of them.
I mean, it seems to me that people are afraid of the nuclear weapons, and Putin knows, and they should be to some extent, and I think Putin knows that and is using it to his advantage. But it's like, okay, he invades Ukraine, and we say, well, we can't We can't even give them missiles that might shoot an Air Force installation because he might use nukes. Where do we draw the line? What if he invades Poland? What if he invades Berlin? What if he invades Paris or London? At what point do we say, okay, fuck it, we have to fight back? Like, if you're not going to engage the guy now, where's the line? Because there is a line. We're not going to let Russia invade New York without fighting back. And that brings us up to the last point. We've talked about the nukes before. I think it's overblown to some degree, but I question whether these things even work, or have they been tested? Like, based on what we've seen from the Russian military, I'm not so sure that any of this shit does what it's supposed to do. But right now, there's the blockade and all this grain that's supposed to go to Africa and Asia and Europe and elsewhere is being blockaded. And Putin's goal, supposedly, or so I've read, is to make that food rot and cause famine in the world. So how much more fucking bullshit can this guy do? I don't understand. Like, what? Can't we give them weapons to blow up these ships and end the blockade? I mean, we're going to have to at some point. So why don't we do it before the people starve? I don't know. Just spitballing here.
None of these tactics and strategies are new. You know, people might have heard about Holodomor, right, which is a famine that the Soviet Union imposed on Ukraine in the 30s. It was a horrible, horrible ordeal where millions died, and it was also silence and wasn't really covered. And there's a sad role that the New York Times played, yes, in it, as you know, the Pulitzer winning journalist who was one of those fifth column, yeah, supporting Kremlin and saying everything is great in Ukraine when people were eating God knows what or not eating and dying.
Walter Duranty, yeah.
Yes, Duranty. And I mean, as far as I know, the New York Times never actually apologized for it, or never, the Pulitzer was never taken away from Duranty. And there's a great, well, I don't know if it's great artistically, but it's a good to learn history. There's a movie, Mr. Jones, made by Andrei Chalupa. And you can watch it, like it pretty much gives you the idea of what was happening. So Holodomor is the strategy, it's a terrorist strategies, because Russia is a mafia state and a terrorist state. So it would terrorize the rest of the world with nukes, which the Soviet Union was doing all alone, and with famine and with anything else they can think of or get their hands on. So when we're talking about nukes, and I believe mentioned that on the previous podcast, we're not talking just about the rusty nukes that might or might not work, Greg, but also we're talking about several nuclear power plants, right, on the territory of Ukraine. I believe they're all in all five. You know, the sad story of Chernobyl, I was writing about it like mad in the beginning, because the first thing that the Russians did was seizing Chernobyl, and then they held hostages the same ship that worked there for more than a month in horrible conditions. And at this point, the people from the nearby town, satellite town, were calling for help. And I interviewed an engineer from Chernobyl, and I had really hard time placing this article. I wanted to run it in America so people could see it. Of course, I ended up having it at the Byline Times, because they're great and not afraid of stuff. But right. I had help, you know, and the reason for it is because the International Atomic Energy Agency, IAEA, infiltrated by Russians. Again, you see the pattern here. It's a known fact, like one of the deputies of the director general of this agency is a Russian with the 30 years of experience of working for Rosatom, which is a state atomic agency in in Russia, you know, run by Kremlin. And they're about, I don't have the numbers now, but over 10, between 10 and 20 employees in the high echelons of this agency. Guess what they're going to say? And they also, there's money involved. I'm actually, one of the things I'm going to work on in plans is like further exploring this this whole theme, you know, of the collaboration or infiltration or call you what may, because currently there's Zaporizhia. So I hope everybody heard that the Russians left Chernobyl and some of them left glowing because they were digging trenches in the what called the Red Forest. And there's the, oh, I don't know if you can hear that.
Yeah.
Yeah, that was the air raid is on.
Okay. Yeah,
I don't have to go anywhere. At this point, I don't go anywhere. It's fine. But it just, you heard it. So it means, what it means, like many people don't know what it means. It means that in our direction, some missiles are flying, most likely from the Black Sea, because they have ships there and they and submarines, and they have been targeting us the last, I don't know, weeks, right? But they have them everywhere. They could be flying from Crimea. So we'll find out afterwards in the aftermath. We don't know. And that means that our air defense is preparing. I don't know if you can hear it. I can, hold on, I'll open the window. You hear, let's, America, let's experience the air raid. So, can you hear?
Yeah.
It's, you know, of course, there's still cars, not many, because mind you, there's not a lot of gas. So most cars are not driving, but it's going on like this quite a bit. And so eventually, hopefully our air defense hits them down. And then that means that fragments still can fall somewhere and injure, kill people or destroy infrastructure.
Right.
And lately they've been very angry because of the, you know, moderate successes in South, you know, and also Zelensky visited Mykolaiv earlier today. So the whole South of Ukraine would be targeted because they usually do that. But whenever someone important is going somewhere, they try to hit or scare. Sure. Again, being a country terrorist. Yeah.
Yeah. Wow. I can't believe that happened when we were on. And right at the end too. Right at the we're laughing about it, but it's terrifying, you know, and that's part of the point, is to terrify the people there to the point where they want it all to stop and they're willing to say, you know, fuck it, take Donbass, we just need to revert to normal.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important, I think, for the United States and for Western Europe and for the democratic countries of the world to really help Ukraine and you know, to fight against this menace. You and I have talked before. I mean, Putin is playing from the Hitler playbook. And this, as you mentioned, the Holodomor, that's a Stalin thing. But in World War II, there was plenty of famines as well. There was famines in the Netherlands, in Belgium, in Greece, that were horrifying. I mean, really horrifying. And that, you know, you don't hear about that as much reading about World War II, but that doesn't mean it didn't happen.
And there's another terrorist weapon, which I was going to say just before the air raid started, because famine in Asian and African countries will lead to migration. And Putin uses migrants in Europe, especially, or in England as well, as a weapon, because that helps to change the political climate and political landscape in these countries. Because with the influx of migrants, the local population is easier radicalized with proper propaganda and, you know, siding right. And traditionally the radical right, I guess, whom are they working with? And whom are they funded by? The Kremlin. So as you could see, that's just another one of the weapons. It again and again, we're talking, it's not just the tanks and the drones and the missiles. We're talking about the hybrid war, and it has many, many aspects to it and many levels. And this is not a laughing matter. And again, I would reiterate that, you know, the major, major battle is in our mind, because the ideas turn into action, as we can see now with the hearing. These people went to the White House because they believed something. The beliefs turn into action. And once you incept or implant a belief, it's only a matter of time before this population will turn on its government or will turn on another country like the Russians now do with Ukraine.
Oh, that's an excellent point. And I'm just grateful because here in the United States, Zarina, we don't have a problem with migrants. Nobody has ever used the threat of migrants coming across the border for political purposes. It's never happened. Oh, wait, never mind. Yeah, the Republicans do. And just to put to hammer the point home, Trump does it. The Republicans do it. They're talking about the border. They're trying to instill fear. And who does this? Fucking Putin does it. All right. Once again, the Republican Party is the Putin Party. It just is. Yep. It's whether it's being directly funded by it, I don't know. But they are doing Putin's bidding. They just are and have been for quite some time. And, you know, we have to fight against it. We have to. Even if and when Putin goes, Patrushev is probably going to take over. He's just as bad, if not worse.
Excellent point, because that's, you know, like when people say, oh, Putin must go, let's get rid of Putin or whatnot. I mean, we can't, but we can wishful thinking, right, exercise. But it's very unlikely that anybody any better would come over, because their whole government, their whole country is poisoned, and it will take years, decades, or thousands of years, I don't know, or never, for them to change. They haven't changed.
No, they haven't changed. I mean, the logical thing to do, okay, if you're, I think Patrushev and Putin are lost, but if you're Lavrov and you have a little bit more savvy, okay, and you manage to take over, the thing to do if you're Russia is to blame Putin, get the troops out of there, and pretend to do a reset and then keep on doing the same shit. That's what, if they're smart, that's what they'll do. I don't know if that's what's going to happen. I think that's the best case scenario. I don't think there's going to be some big uprising and Navalny's going to be the president or anything like that. I think the best that we can hope for is somebody like Lavrov, who isn't quite as lost mentally as these other two, will take over and frame the war, get out of the war, blame it on the other people, and figure out a way to spin it as a victory and then keep going. And then hold out his hand and beg for money from the West, you know, which is, they're good at this.
Well, my closing word on that, after many years of I succeeded to escape it. You know, it's been after me like some horrid monster, but I think I finally found my peace. I don't think it has me anymore. It's as foreign to me as to you, but I've been close to it, and it's monstrous. And my advice to anybody, don't try to understand it. Even they quote constantly the poetry line, which says like, you can't understand Russia with mind, that you can't measure it with a general measure. Don't do it, because you'll never understand it. It's entirely, they look deceptively similar to everybody else, but the whole mental picture, the whole world is so different that it would be a mistake to try to make any prognosis on what they're going to do, what they're going to decide. None of it is logical. This war wasn't logical. Every monstrous thing they do seems impossible, because it's not a sane person or sane people's or sane country or nation mind, right? It's unhealthy. It's like dealing with a crazy man, well, ill, very, very ill, monstrous individual. Don't go there.
Yeah. I think you're right. And you know, God, I'm never going to be able to understand it. I mean, you're right. None of it makes any sense. It's not, it part of it isn't supposed to make any sense. And no. I just hope that something changes where we can get some inroads into this guy and you know, win.
Yeah. Well, hopefully, you know, I mean, the most reasonable and down to earth, the least sci-fi scenario would be that the economy is so weak that they can't do any more damage in this world. There are plenty of big countries in this world that they're so poor that they basically can't do anything to the rest of the world. And that is my sincere hope, you know, and then they can do whatever they want to themselves. Right. You know, whoever is still left there honest, I'm sure there's few who can't leave for personal circumstances. I mean, I know, say, a gay couple who are about to leave, but their parents are dying from cancer, right? Like that's a Carnelian dilemma. Like, but they're very few. The rest of them, they can deal with themselves. If they want to live in a dictatorship and like, not, you know, like there are countries like this, North Korea, if you want to do it, do it. Nobody's going to care. Do it to yourself. Don't do it to others.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. So I don't know, you know, we can hope. And the thing about the economy that you said, this is a Biden thing. Biden said, you know, he put that in motion and allied NATO and the Western powers, which was an alliance that Donald Trump spent 4 years trying to break. And the NATO and the Western alliance has kept Europe, with very little exception, free of war amongst each other since 1945. So Trump fucking with that is very, very dangerous. I think a lot of people don't understand how dangerous that is. Biden put that back together. And he is leading the Western alliance in this economic attack on Russia. And, you know, it's an attack that takes a while to ramp up. But once it's ramped up, it's like casting a magic spell. You know, if you play Dungeons and Dragons, the fighters and the people with the swords are out in front while the magic user is in the back, because it takes time to conjure this powerful spell. The economic thing is the powerful spell.
Yeah, well, there's always the but, you know, like it's like ongoing. Yeah. But you know, you can't fight the monster with one arm and feed it with another. So, you know, Europe really needs to cut down on the gas. And there are other options. They can buy liquefied gas from other places. They already have conversations going with Egypt. They're, you know, Russia is not the only country in the world that produces fossil fuel and produces gas and oil. There are other ways of doing it. And until they cut it down and take themselves off that needle, that dragon ain't going to die or ain't going to kill itself, you know?
Yeah, no, that's true. Zarina Zabriskie, we can follow you on Twitter. It's at Zarina Zabriskie with a Y at the end. You've already outlined where we can find your stuff on the Byline Times, at the what's the new one, the ByWire?
ByWire.
Okay.
ByWire News and Euromaidan Press, which I recommend.
Yeah,
that's right. A gem. Yeah.
These are all great great publications, and you know, you've been doing such spectacular work in very adverse circumstances, and you know, I'm a great admirer of you for you know, for doing what you're doing. And I hope that you stay safe, please. And you know, keep up the good work, because not everybody is in the position to be doing what you're doing. And I just have the world of respect for you for doing it. So.
Thank you so much, Greg. And likewise, this goes to you. Thank you for holding up. I feel like I betrayed America for now, but I can't fight for two countries. I've been fighting for America for a long time. And now I know that you and LB and other people are, you know, there and doing the work that needs to be done. So thank you a lot for everything that you do. I always follow with such interest and admiration. And thank you everyone for listening. And thank you for keeping Ukraine in your thoughts and helping out. I know that there's a lot of issues internally, but I hope that you will find time and you'll find humanity to keep these brave people in your hearts and in your thoughts and not dismiss it as a war of attrition or something that is happening in a faraway world where all are connected. It's all very close. So thank you so much for being here and listening.
It's the same fight, man. It's just the same fight on different fronts. You know, it's the fight against the fascists, against the people that want democracy. It's really, it could not be more simple in those terms. And we're all, you know, you're on one side or the other. You can't be neutral. No, you can't be Davos in this fight. You got to pick a side. You're with the fascists or you're with the forces of democracy. So Zarina Zabriskie, stay safe. We'll talk to you soon. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you, Greg.
The Prevail theme song is by Matthew Fassa. Sofia Tereshenko provided the Russian introduction. Voice talent is provided by Tally Briggs, Signet Della, Stephanie St. John, Brett Petticord, Ryan Byrne at History Falls Apart, and me. Thanks to Allison Gill, Molly Hawkey, Kenai Williams, and everyone else at MSW Media. Please subscribe to the Prevail website with updates every Tuesday, Friday, and Sunday. Your $5 monthly subscription funds the site and the podcast. Visit gregoliar.com to learn more. Thanks for listening. Drive safely. Don't forget to tip your server. Until next time, we shall prevail.
MSW.